Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah, the Frontlines of Freedom team appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Here's what we have for you this hour. We'll start by talking with Pat Girondi about his book on leadership. At least that's what I call it, it's dealing with issues. Then we'll meet First Sergeant Walters from the Mounted Color Guard at Fort Riley, Kansas. And then Marine vet Chris Whitmore will discuss his book, From Terror to Triumph. Of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce veteran Patrick Girondi. He's written a very interesting book. He's been through some really tough times. And it's also interestingly named. It's The Flight of the Rondon. I'll let him tell you about that, what the Rondon is. So, Patrick, welcome. Glad you could join us.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Patrick, you had an atypical life. You atypically got in the military for a while. A pretty tough youth. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I mean, my youth was pretty typical for people from our neighborhood. We're a blue-collar neighborhood in the south side of Chicago. 13 brothers and sisters from mixed parents, let's say that way. It was very challenging, but very wonderful at the same time. So I ended up getting in some scrapes as a kid, like a lot of us. And luckily, Judge Clarence Bryant sent me to the military. The only military I could go to was the Air Force, because at that time it was the only one that had delayed enlistment program available. I was only 16. And I got in the military, got out of the military, ended up getting lucky. You know, I was a trader at the Chicago Board of Trade, Chicago Mercantile Exchange. I was on Oprah Winfrey's show twice as a guest, the first time for Rags to Riches stories. And I really lived the American dream. All of the things that were challenging, and we all have challenges, you know, I look back at them and thank God for every one of them. You know, I mean, they make us who we are.
They are. Nobody lives a wonderful life. Some of us live tougher ones, but all of us hit times where we're hit really hard more than once.
Every one of us.
And your hit may be different than my hit, but we get the hits. And those who tough it out, suck it up, and make it work are generally more successful in life. That's a fair statement, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the old, good old American way. I mean, of course, we grew up in different times, you know, where you didn't snitch on anybody and, you know, just very different situations than we have into modern day America. But I held close and hold close to, our heritage. And I became an American entrepreneur. And what that means to me to be an American capitalist, it means the boss sacrifices before anyone else sacrifices. And so I know that unfortunately today, when you look at the corporate world, you have a lot of stories. For example, Lehman Brothers, when they went bankrupt with all of these people's pensions, you know, the CEO got a $34 million golden parachute. Well, we come from a different time when you didn't do those kind of things and it wasn't honorable. And that's the kind of guy that I was. So it was a great life. I had a lot of adversity. I confronted it. And just like you're saying, you know, when we confront, the more adversity we confront, the stronger we get and the better we get. And the more experiences we have, the easier it is to handle every curveball that comes at us.
Amen. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with author Patrick Girondi. Okay, Pat, tell us about the title of your book and then take us to your book.
Sure. So Flight of the Rondone. Basically, my son was diagnosed with a rare blood disease in about 1992, and he was on experimental medicine in the United States, but it was very expensive and he had to live in the hospital. So I ended up moving to Italy, actually 20 miles from where my grandparents came from, and opened up a medical center for my son. He basically was on this experimental medicine, and he avoided blood transfusions in the 90s when you really needed to, because the antibody for AIDS and hepatitis C weren't discovered yet. And so it was literally a huge risk every time he transfused. So he was on these drugs, arginine butyrate, until about 1998, 1999, and then he began transfusing. And by that time, I was in Italy. I was partners with John Walton of Walmart starting in 1995. He was my partner until 2004. And in 2000, I met the researcher, which I knew would save my son's life. He had the gene therapy to cure sickle cell disease and thalassemia, my son's disease. Sickle cell disease and thalassemia are cousins' diseases. So I got on board with him. And in 2005, we bought the worldwide rights to that product. And in 2010, we delivered the first commercial batch of gene therapy to the world. Unfortunately, the whole project was sabotaged by Bluebird Bio, by Third Rock Ventures, and it culminated into a huge court case, which ended in November of 2020. It was a difficult time for me. The court case was difficult. Having a son with that problem was difficult. And during my hardest times, I had so many people, good people, friends, who picked me up and threw me back up into the air. Well, the rondone is a bird who immigrates to Italy every year in March from South Africa. It travels up to 140 miles an hour, but it has a very short body and very long wings. So it has to land 2 to 3 stories high so that it can then throw itself into the wind and start flying again. When by chance they end up on the ground, either because they collide or they're young and they fall, everyone in my town knows what they need to do. You need to cup the bird in your hand, take it from between your legs, and throw it as hard as you can into the sky so that it can begin flapping its wings. And I believe that there have been, you know, a half dozen or even a dozen people who in my lifetime have picked me up and threw me into the air. One of them actually was in basic training. I was in basic training. It was supposed to be 6 weeks. I wasn't the easiest guy, and I smirked and I laughed and I did some things probably that aggravated my TI, and they wanted to throw me out. And there was a dark-skinned judge named, sergeant named Sergeant Smith, and he was a master sergeant. And he wouldn't allow them to throw me out of the Air Force. They ended up throwing me into something called motivation for 5 weeks, but I ended up getting, you know, out of the basic training and eventually getting an honorable discharge. So, you know, Master Sergeant Smith was one of those guys who picked me up when I was on the ground and threw me into the air. And that's where the name of the book comes from.
And the book is incredible. The things that Patrick faced and didn't give up, to make an understatement, I'm overwhelmed. And to see all this going on while you're trying to save the life of your son is incredible. And I wish we could go into it more, but we can't. How can listeners buy a copy, get a copy of your book, Patrick?
Yes, it's Flight of the Rondoni, Patrick Girondi, and they can get it on Amazon or BAM or Target. You can get it in a lot of different places. So I really appreciate it. And anyone who has a child with a rare disease or is facing challenges such as the ones I've described, I think it'd be a great feel-good book. And I really appreciate the support.
It's an incredible book, and particularly if you're up against something that you think looks too hard to deal with, you can deal with it. All you've got to do is do it. Patrick, thank you.
Thank you,
Dennis. Thank you for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your service to our nation in uniform, and thank you for the role model that you are for all Americans. I'm proud to call you friend.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it. I'm proud as well. Thank you, sir.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with First Sergeant Walters from Fort Riley, Kansas. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. It's time to run hard for a couple of miles. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back.
Fellow Americans, we need your help. PatriotFoods.com. We are fighting for the American farmer. U.S.-only fruits and vegetables from your soil. Go to PatriotFoods.com, use your promo code FREEDOM, and you get 10% off today. Support your U.S. farmer. Promo code FREEDOM, 10% off. Thank you so much.
It's great food. I eat it. This is Colonel Denny Gillum, PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
We were instrumental in passing the VA Mission Act so more veterans could have options and freedom in their health care. We're leading the charge to end America's endless wars, bringing thousands of troops home and stopping trillions of dollars from being wasted. Our key to success? You. We bring your voice to our nation's leaders so we can all have a better future. We are concerned veterans for America. the voice of veterans for freedom and prosperity. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement.
If you are suffering from anxiety, joint muscle aches, or trouble sleeping, try Day 3 Creation, a Christian family-owned provider of American-made, non-intoxicating, non-addictive CBD products created from natural, organic, laboratory-tested ingredients. Day 3 comes from a servant's heart as God calls us to care for each other with compassion and honesty. 10% of all profits go to Patriot Paws, providing disabled vets with service dogs. Visit day3creation.com to learn more. God bless. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Front Lines of Freedom. Today, we're starting a series of interviews with some interesting military folks that I met in May while visiting the great folks at Berry Law, a team dedicated to helping vets. It's a pleasure to welcome to the show First Sergeant Roy Walters. He's with the Commanding General's Mounted Color Guard with the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley, Kansas. Glad to have you join us, Top.
Pleasure to be here.
First Sergeant, you've been in the Army obviously a while, or you wouldn't be a First Sergeant. When and why did you join, and what are some of the assignments you had?
All right, so I joined in 2003, so 9/11 was my senior year. Obviously, I was ready to go. Went down to the recruiter's office, and I made it all the way through, found out I was colorblind. So I couldn't be combat arms, and that was disappointing at the time because I was ready to go defend my, come back after 9/11. Uh-huh. About a year later, the recruiter saw me. I'd broke my knee playing church softball. And he said, combat medic. You can be a combat medic and be colorblind. I don't know how that math added up. But so he got me in, and it was exactly what I wanted. First duty station right out the gate, good old Fort Polk, Louisiana. Mm. Two tours out of there to Iraq in 07 and 09. From there, I moved to Carson, and I did about a year in the hospital, working the outlying clinics. That right there was not mine, coming from a line medic and a couple tours.
I believe that would be not fun.
Yeah. So I called Branch and I said, hey, what you got? And they said, do you want to go to Hawaii? And I said, when do they deploy? Because they don't always offer that unless there's a catch 22. They said in about 6 months. So I called the wife and said, hey, this might be a good time with a little one, get the next one out of the way. And so we went to Hawaii, deployed out of there. I got lucky. I was the colonel's medic, so I flew everywhere up in RC East. And then out of there, I did some AMED recruiting.
That makes sense. It's my experience from my 2 years in combat in Vietnam that being a medic was a dangerous position in combat. And that's not for everybody, but I had either a platoon or a company medic in combat as an infantryman. Those guys, they had to be darn good at everything.
I feel there's a lot of weight as a medic because it's the way to life. I would say that equally, we all share the same danger. I think sometimes medics can get ahead of themselves because a medic that rushes out sometimes too soon isn't always the best medic if he goes down. So I had a good team around me, and I was able to do my job when I needed to.
Well, that's good judgment, not just knee-jerk, ooh, go. Sort of helps you get all the way through life in almost everything, right?
Yes, sir.
And particularly if you're doing something dangerous.
That's correct.
But, and again, it wasn't that I saw my medics do dangerous things. It's just that they were always where the bad things were happening. And sometimes they got hurt, sometimes they didn't. The funniest, happiest thing that happened when my platoon was out on patrol and we were taking a break and some bad guy threw a grenade in and none of us got hurt, but we turned mm-hmm. fire and moved out real mm-hmm. quick. And my medic a few minutes later came up and said, you've got a bad cut on your hand. So he put a bandage mm-hmm. on and I got a Purple Heart. So Well, it was in combat, or it may have been the sea ration can I was cooking my lunch on that I dropped. It was either that or the grenade. I'm not sure.
Well, you got the Purple Heart now.
Hey, I did.
Isn't that the enemy's marksmanship?
Yes, something happened there, and it was interesting. So you've served as a medic a lot of different places. Right now, you're at Fort Riley, Kansas, mm-hmm. and you're running a mounted color guard. Mm-hmm. What's your mission? What do you do? How do you do it?
Okay, so the color guard started in 1993, essentially were representing Fort Riley's rich cavalry heritage. You go back, they had the cavalry school, Colonel Custer, the Buffalo Soldiers, and the final resting place of chief. So back in the late 1800s into the 1930s, you had that cavalry history. We have the opportunity to keep that history and heritage alive by riding horses representing the 1st Infantry Division in the Army.
That makes sense. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. We're talking with 1st Sergeant Roy Walters. So I suspect that means you're basically on show, on display, pretty much nonstop. I don't mean 24/7, 365, but what you're doing is either on display or practicing so that you look darn good when you are on display. Am I right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we definitely put in the time. If we're not down in the arena riding, then, you know, keeping upkeep of the stables, because the actual stables that we're at are the 1889 stables. And so people can come there at any point and just visit. So it's almost like a museum tour daily.
Well, that's cool. And one thing is for sure, throughout the history of warfare, horses have played a huge role. Not so much right now. But you never know about the future, but it certainly is a huge part of our military, particularly our Army's history, isn't it?
Yes, sir. And that's why we feel so fortunate. And for whatever reason, because maybe how modern the world has got, but yet people still love the horse. You can just bring a horse out there in any time and it'll just draw a crowd. Maybe more so than the troopers. They just flock to those horses.
Well, and that's reasonable because they're amazing. And, you know, if we get one of these big things that knocks out all the satellites and everything, we may be back to using horses again.
We'll be good to go.
You know, and if that ever happens, I know who to call.
Call me if the satellite works for your cell phone.
First Sergeant, give me a quick summary of the mounted color guard. About how many are they? About how often do you do things?
Okay. Yeah. So right now I got about 28 soldiers. I got about 26 in my herd. So mostly quarter horses. And then I have a mule team. And then historically they ran about 240 days out of the year or events out of the year. I'm down to about 160 events all throughout the nation. From later on in the year, we'll head to Cheyenne, Wyoming, down into Oklahoma. So we're all over.
Well, I don't think you probably fly your horses, so I'm guessing trains or trucks.
Oh, we pull them in the trailer, so there's some long days hauling, sir.
And apparently the horses put up with it, so you obviously know how to do it and to take care of them en route.
We do, and we're getting even better from this year. So as we plan ahead, right, as we would, you don't just get there and hit the road with the horses. We actually plan in a down day for the horses because we really want to take care of them and honor them as well.
Well, thank you, First Sergeant. We met at Barry Law's celebrations for Memorial Day in Omaha, Nebraska. That's where we met, and who knows where we'll meet next. Thank you for your service, First Sergeant. Thanks for taking time to join us today, and thank you for the way you're serving our nation now. I'm proud to call you a friend.
I appreciate it, sir, and I appreciate your service in the Big Red One.
Ooh-wah. Coming up next on Front Lines of Freedom, we'll talk with Marine combat vet Chris Whitmore about his book, Terror to Triumph. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Danny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm, twice, then take a break but stay in the area. I'll be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
HelpVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HelpVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at HelpVet.net. Visit HelpVet.net for all your family's needs.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Troops, I do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. It's a pleasure to welcome Marine veteran Chris Whitmore to the show. He's a scout sniper in combat, or he was. Then there's Living with Combat. He's written a book about his journey, Terror to Triumph. Welcome aboard, Chris. That's what I'm supposed to say to a jarhead, a Marine, right? Welcome
aboard. Well, it's sort of like that Navy terminology, but it works. It works.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me on here. And yeah, I think it's going to be a great time.
When and why did you decide to join the Marines?
Oh, let's see. The when was way back in the old days, as I call it, with some of these younger guys. But back in 1995, I ended up joining the Marine Corps and out of California. All my relatives have served in the military in some form or fashion, whether it be my uncle and my father were in the Navy in Vietnam. My grandfather was in the Navy, but was awarded the Silver Star in Pearl Harbor. He was actually on the base during the bombings. And my uncle Pat was actually in the, when you said 101st, I was like, oh, but he was in the airborne in Vietnam, but I can't remember for the life of me. I think it was the 82nd?
Yes. 82nd Airborne. Yep.
So he was with the 82nd in Vietnam, and they all served, you know, honorably, got out doing completely different things. My grandfather, you know, passed away about 10 years ago. But, you know, I always wanted to be in the military. It was kind of like a family lineage, you know, if you will. 90% of the males all served in the military. So I was like, well, it's going to be kind of my pathway too. But I knew I didn't want to float on a boat. I didn't want to be in the Army. And for as long as my mother can remember, from the time that I saw the Marines walking around with the dress blue uniform and all that stuff, the spit and polish aspect, I was like, you know what? That's what I want to be. That's what I want to do. And so ended up joining the Marines in the 90s. And it was just kind of a, I don't want to use the word calling, but it was just something that, you know, I always saw myself doing, and had a great run, if you will. Yeah, had a great run.
How did you end up as a scout sniper? Were you just a really good shot, or is that something to volunteer for, or how does that work?
Yeah, after I got out, I only did the first 4 years, you know, back in the 90s. It was post-Gulf War. Nothing was really going on. So got out in 99, went back in 2004. And I told the recruiter, I don't care what job you give me, and I don't care where you station me. I just want back in the military. Well, as anyone knows, the recruiter is like, yes, like manna from heaven. And they said, well, you're going to be in the infantry and you're going to 29 Palms, California. I was like, okay, I know what the infantry is. Where the hell is 29 Palms, California? And he's like, you see this little dot between Barstow and Palm Springs? That's where you're going. I'm like, okay, sounds good. Ironically, the Army actually deemed that base uninhabitable, but the Marines are like, nope, we're going to make a giant base out of this. And here we go. We're going to send all these people out there. Once I got there, though, that unit had just got back from Alkheim, Iraq, their 2004 deployment. And we were doing some training and workups for the upcoming 2005 deployment to Ramadi, Iraq. And they came around and said, hey, who wants to basically do the indoc to be a scout sniper? And I'm like, well, I'm back in. I'm, you know, not getting any younger. So, you know, why not? Let's give it a go. And so, you know, read all the books, the Carlos Hathcock and the, you know, the different sniper books, and my envision of what being a sniper was back then to what it was in 2005, very, very different. But did the indoc, passed, joined the teams in, I want to say November of 04, and we deployed in September of 05. So I had about 8 months of kind of like a OJT a little bit, joined the teams, and we ended up deploying. I think during that indoc, myself and three others passed and joined the team. And one decided right before we deployed that he didn't want to be with the sniper teams. He wanted to be with the gun trucks who he trained with before. So we left the team and went back to regular infantry. And we ended up deploying. And it was that was when it got really wild.
I believe that. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Marine vet Chris Whitmore. Okay, Chris, you're a scout sniper and you deployed. Take a minute and talk about your experiences in combat.
Oh, let's see. The different deployment, hands down, the worst one was definitely the 2005 deployment. You know, it was with the sniper teams. We went to Ramadi, Iraq, which they've, you know, made movies and books and, you know, all this stuff about the different battles throughout this city. When we got there, though, there was still no elected officials. There was still no, it was just a war-torn city. The buildings were, you know, crumbled down on top of each other. Piles of rock and dirt and animals and things like that lined the streets, just a hotbed for IEDs, you know, or booby traps or just 1,000 possibilities. When we got over there, you know, I was at first like, okay, you know, this is Iraq. Cool. You know, heard the horror stories about this, but we didn't really feel like we were really in it just yet because we were waiting on doing the transition with the outgoing unit. So about by the fifth day in, we were walking to the cafeteria or the chow hall or whatever. And that was our first experience as a indirect fire rocket came onto base, basically thinking we were safe out of the city. You know, we were out of harm's way. Rocket came flying in, landed next to a HESCO barrier where a bunch of Marines had stopped to smoke. There was part of our company and it landed right next to them and right from the jump. So we knew like, okay, we could be in the city. We could be back at base. It doesn't matter for the next 7 months. Like every step, every breath is going to be, could be your last. So just accept it now that nowhere is safe. And for the next 7 months, you know, it's going to just be, it's just going to be bad. You know, during that deployment, we lost tons and tons of guys to injuries, to, we lost some of our EOD teams. One of the stories in the book that really hits home that a lot of people hear and they just kind of, you know, cringe a little bit, which is kind of odd because it's like it is combat, you know, it's when people get hurt, things like that, you know, things are going to happen. But one thing that we always prided ourselves on is no matter what happens to us, we never wanted to see the young kids get hurt. That was always our thing. That was like our team's. Whatever, if it happens to us or it happens to a fighting age male, then, you know, so be it. If it happens to a little kid, you know, because of something we did, then it became very personal. And that happened on one major occasion. You know, we took over a hide site or our little area and the family was really cool. They fed us, they gave us tea, they gave us, you know, comfortable chairs to sit in while we were on guard posts and stuff like that. It was really great. And they had this young girl that was about 7 years old. And I go into more detail in the book on this, but so it was definitely a very moving story and a very, you know, very hard thing, but it you know, that stuff happens.
Yeah, it does. And then after you got through with that, you had to come home and deal with whatever you want to call it, but it's the feelings of one, having been in combat, what you did there, and two, not being with your team. That's a struggle too, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. You know, returning home each time, you know, after each deployment was always something different. You know, if the initially it was, okay, I'm going to come back and isolate, drink, not be able to sleep, be constantly on guard, constantly fighting the issues, whatever that might be. So it's definitely very challenging.
And that's why I think you named your book From Terror to Triumph, because you did go through that, but you didn't give up there either. You fought through it. I think I got that right. How can listeners get a copy of Terror to Triumph? Where is it available?
It is available on Amazon. Anywhere that you Google the book title or my name, it's going to pop up on about 6 to 8 different pages. I'm about to launch my own webpage for the book. TareToTriumphBooks.com. It's going to be launched hopefully by the middle of July. But besides Amazon, it's also on Kindle and also on Audible. We just launched the audiobook 2 weeks ago.
Well, I certainly recommend the book. Thank you, Chris, for taking time to join us today. And thank you for your service to our nation. I appreciate you, brother.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. And hopefully people get out there and read the book. And please, if you do read the book, love the stars, but please leave a comment.
Amen. Troops, if you're a veteran having trouble getting your disability approved by the VA, contact Barry Law. Reach them at PTSDlawyers.com. This is Colonel Danny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You've reported for duty to Frontlines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some push-ups. Maybe 53 this time. We need to be Ranger ready. Then stand at ease. Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at Danny@frontlinesoffreedom.com, or you can do it on Facebook. Skip, what's the first comment? Indeed, I think you just won this week.
Well, Army veteran Vic said the congressional committee investigating the happenings on January 6th got him thinking. Here's what he found was happening on January 6th of last year. Gas was $1.93 per gallon. There was zero inflation. The supply chain was functioning well. The economy was the strongest in 50 years. The border was controlled and secure. The Taliban wasn't armed with artillery and weapons. There were plenty of workers to fill worker needs. The stock market was a record high. 401ks had record high values, and interest rates were at record lows. Vic says he sort of misses that.
Vic, I think I see what you're saying. It's amazing what real leadership in Washington can do. Maybe we can have some in the future. Okay, now it's time for military history. What's first, Skip? Take us there, man.
Well, on July 11th, 1798, President John Adams signed the bill that reestablished the Marine Corps. The Continental Congress had disbanded the service in 1783 at the end of the American Revolution. The Marine Corps, however, recognizes its official birthday to be the date that the Second Continental Congress first authorized the establishment of the Corps of Marines on 10 November 1775. To add the confusion of the Corps' actual historical birthday, on July 1, 1797, Congress authorized the revenue cutters to carry, in addition to their regular crew, up to 30 Marines. Congress directed the cutters to interdict French privateers during the quasi-war with France and thought the additional firepower of 30 Marines would be needed by the undermanned and undergunned cutters. It is unknown if any Marines were enlisted for service with the revenue cutters during this time.
And on 12 July 1862, during the Civil War, President Lincoln signed a measure awarding a U.S. Army Medal of Honor in the name of Congress to such non-commissioned officers and privates as shall distinguish themselves by their gallantry in action and other soldierly-like qualities during the present insurrection. The previous December, Lincoln had approved a provision creating a U.S. Navy Medal of Valor, which was the basis of the Army Medal of Honor. The first soldiers to receive what would become the nation's highest military honor were six members of a Union raiding party who in 1862 penetrated deep into Confederate territory to destroy bridges and railroad tracks between Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Atlanta, Georgia. In 1863, the Medal of Honor was made a permanent military decoration available to all members, including commissioned officers, of the U.S. military. It is conferred to those who have distinguished themselves in actual combat at risk of life beyond the call of duty. Since its creation, almost 3,400 men and one woman has received the Medal of Honor for heroic actions in U.S. military conflict.
And on July 11, 1941, Congress reconfirmed the military status of the Coast Guard, stating, The Coast Guard shall be a military service and constitute a branch of the land and naval forces of the United States at all times and shall operate under the Treasury Department in time of peace and operate as part of the Navy, subject to the orders of the Secretary of the Navy in time of war or when the President shall so direct.
And on 15 July 1943, during World War II, Marine Captain Joe Foss bagged three Japanese planes for a record total of 26 kills. He was the Marine's leading fighter ace during World War II and received the Medal of Honor, recognizing his role in the air combat during the Guadalcanal campaign. In post-war years, he achieved fame as a general in the Air National Guard, the 20th governor of South Dakota, the president of the National Rifle Association, and the first commissioner of the American Football League. Not bad for a Marine.
Thank you, Colonel. Hoorah. On July 14, 1964, the U.S. military intelligence publicly charged that North Vietnamese regular army officers command and fight in so-called Viet Cong forces in the northern provinces, where Viet Cong strength had doubled in the past 6 months. South Vietnamese General Nguyen Khan referred to the invasion by North Vietnamese army forces. There would soon be other evidence that North Vietnamese troops were operating in South Vietnam. In August, South Vietnamese officials would claim that two companies from the North Vietnamese army had crossed the demilitarized zone in Quang Tri province. A battle ensued, but the North Vietnamese forces were defeated with heavy casualties. It became known later that Hanoi had ordered its forces to begin infiltrating to the south. This marked a major change in the tempo and scope of the war in South Vietnam and resulted in President Lyndon Johnson committing U.S. combat troops.
And on 12 July 1966, the National Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy and American Socialist Norman Thomas appealed to North Vietnamese President Ho Chi Minh on behalf of captured American pilots. The number of American captives was on the increase due to the intensification of Operation Rolling Thunder, the U.S. bombing campaign against North Vietnam. On 15 July, 18 senators opposed to President Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam policy signed a statement calling on North Vietnam to, quote, refrain from any act of vengeance against American airmen, end quote. The next day, the UN Secretary General also urged North Vietnam to exercise restraint in the treatment of American prisoners of war. On July 19th, the North Vietnamese ambassadors in Beijing and Prague asserted that the captured Americans would go on trial as war criminals. However, Ho Chi Minh subsequently gave assurances of a humanitarian policy towards the prisoners. In response, he said, to the appeal that he received from Sane and Norman Thomas. Despite Ho's assurances, American POWs were routinely mistreated and tortured. They were released in 1973 as a part of the provisions of the Paris Peace Accord that were signed on January 27, 1973. And that's military history for today. And now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Front Lines of Freedom want our listeners to get trained and get armed in that order. We fully support the right to keep and bear arms for all law-abiding families, and we encourage you to find out about the laws governing use of deadly force in your state and follow them to the letter. And of course, don't forget to follow the rules of safety and common sense whenever you're carrying a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, an armed citizen tried intervening in an armed robbery and ended up being in a shootout with two suspects and was shot as a result. The incident happened around 3:40 a.m. at a 7-Eleven in Grandview, Missouri. The armed citizen noticed the robbery in progress, grabbed his own weapon, and tried to intervene. They exchanged gunfire, and the armed citizen was shot at least once. He was transported to the hospital and is expected to survive. It's not known if either of the armed robbers was shot during the exchange, as both fled and haven't been apprehended.
Thanks, Colonel. This is a tough scenario to win, and I would be hesitant to engage multiple assailants in an all-out gunfight unless I had certain advantages. If you're going to try something like this, then here are some things to consider. First, it's extremely important that you are shooting from behind cover. Remember, cover will stop a bullet, but concealment will only hide you. So that rules out the Twinkie rack. You want to be behind thick wood, stone or brick, or even a steel load-bearing support beam. This is vitally important because chances are you're going to get shot at during this gunfight. It's possible to neutralize one man before he can bring his gun to bear on you, but two attackers is different. While you're shooting the first assailant, the second will be taking aim and shooting at you. Next time you're inside a gas station or convenience store, take a look around and list off everything you could use for cover. I think you'll be surprised to find there is very little true cover in these establishments. Second, you need the element of surprise. You'll have to get the first shot off and you have to make it count. It's very important that you even the odds right away. If you don't, then you're outnumbered and it will be easier for them to flank you. Once that happens, your chances of survival go way down. Third, you need to be calm under stress. If you don't stay calm, then you'll likely not make good shots, and this scenario isn't very forgiving. Fourth, you need to spend time on the range in preparation for a gunfight like this. Gunfighting against multiple assailants is an advanced skill, and if you haven't practiced it, then you won't be able to pull it off. Fifth, make sure you have enough ammo to succeed. I wouldn't try this with a five-shot revolver. On average, it takes 3 hits to the upper chest to stop the threat, so that leaves you 1 round shy. And that's assuming you're a perfect shot under stress, which no one is. If I have to go up against more than one assailant, I want 20 rounds and a pistol that's highly accurate, and that means a longer barrel. Most people don't carry a gun like this. And finally, assume that you're going to be injured and be prepared to fight through the pain until the end. Never give up. Most average concealed carry holders will not prevail in a scenario like this unless they have these advantages. Think about it in advance and don't overestimate your abilities. Frontlines of Freedom is glad this man survived, but we deeply regret that he was unable to stop the two robbers in this incident. Practice every week and make sure you have cover, the right tool for the job, and a strong warrior mindset. Because if you don't, then the odds of you going home to your family at night go way, way down.
You are very accurate there, Skip. Thank you. Our movie of the month is Our Kind of Love. It was the movie for May, but the mess up on our website kept many listeners from being able to watch it. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can watch it for free. We reviewed it at the end of the month, and I'd appreciate getting your comments about it. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, General Paul Mock, a retired Army general and retired police officer, will discuss how much we need police and how bad we're treating them. Then Air Force vet Sam Peters will discuss his reasons for running for office, and we'll meet Army Specialist Seifring, a member of the Fort Leavenworth Mounted Color Guard. And Steve Wilson will share how helpvet.net works. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. You can purchase the book at frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you won't get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.